on, so now it's recording. So, LaCrista, would you mind just to test this and make sure we like know where the interview starts?
Sure.
Would you mind spelling your first and last name?
Mm-hmm. LaCrista, LaCrista, Greco, Greco.
Great. Can I just move this a tiny bit closer?
I can move closer too if that's easier. Let's do that. I'm like really far from you, kind of, so that's easier. Is that better?
I think that's perfect.
Okay.
Great. So, LaCrista, thank you so much for making time for this.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we could start by just talking about like background, like early life. So,
sure.
When and where were you born?
I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, in 1985, December 12th, 1985.
Did you grew up in Madison, right?
I grew up in Madison on the west side, and then my parents divorced, and my father lived in Middleton, and so I was in the Middleton school district, which was terrible, but that's a whole other story. So I mostly lived in Middleton then growing up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is the Middleton School District being terrible something you want to go into or not?
Sure,
not so
we
much?
Can. Okay. I mean, it mostly has to do with the fact that I was in third grade diagnosed with two learning disabilities. And so dyscalculia, which is the math version of dyslexia, and then a language processing disorder. So it was, you know, this was like the early 90s, and really how they dealt with that was they segregated the special ed kids from traditional classrooms, and so I'd be pulled out of a traditional classroom to go to a special ed class a lot of times, and it was just not, I mean, I had a lot of teachers who were very awful, so the school district was not the best, to say the least, so.
Yeah, that sounds hard.
Yeah, it was, but yeah, I mean, thankfully I had a few really good teachers, and my parents were really fierce advocates for me growing up, so they would be like in and out of meetings with teachers who were mean to me or who were, you know, just didn't understand how to teach me or didn't have the time to try to, you know, understand how to teach me. So that I was really thankful for that growing up. But yeah, the school district was kind of, and from what I've heard, it still is fairly behind on, you know, working with, people with disabilities. And so that's unfortunate to hear because it's 2020 and I would have hoped that when I experienced this in the 90s, that, you know, would have gotten better, but it doesn't really sound like it has, so that's unfortunate. But I made it through, and yeah, so.
What do you remember about some of the teachers who were really good?
So I always really excelled in English. That was probably my favorite class, and so most English teachers I had, I loved. And they were also just, I mean, I had one in particular who was just very kind and supportive of me and let me sort of go at my own pace with things, which was really helpful. You know, really tried to lift me up and not, you know, push me down, which I've had teachers do before. So really kind of just things like that, being supportive and, being able to, you know, mentor me and be helpful, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so.
Do you remember anyone's name?
Yeah, sure. I can say it's okay to say it. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's nice things.
Yeah, sure. Right, yeah. It's true. Ms. Finnegan, she was always very supportive and probably my favorite teacher when I was in high school. Middle school, I don't think I really had any. I went to Cromrie Middle School. And then I went to Elm Lawn for elementary school. And I think, I had one teacher there, second grade, Mrs. Gunlock, who was really supportive and accommodating and very a great teacher as well. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So English was your favorite subject. Mm-hmm. Were there any other things about school that you enjoyed? Any other subjects or extracurriculars?
I mean, I liked art, but I never felt like good at it. And so I never really pursued it, which kind of makes me sad. But like, I'm kind of pursuing it now, which is funny, but I'm not good at it, I don't think. But in terms of extracurriculars, I was a dancer for 13 years. So I started ballet and jazz when I was 7, I think. Yeah. So, and I did that outside of school. I did soccer for like a very short amount of time, but I found very quickly that I was not interested in sports. And so dance was much more my speed, and I really loved being able to meet like people from other schools there, because it was not related to Middleton. It got me to sort of branch out with like my friend group and things like that, and really was just a great, you know, physical activity to do, and really great for my mental health, I think, too, growing up, and just being able to move my body in different ways. And yeah, so.
Totally. 13 years, so you like mm-hmm. really stuck with it.
I did, yeah, until I went to college, which I wish I wouldn't have like stopped then, but I mean, it was kind of like, I don't know that I'll have the time, and I didn't really have the time, so I kind of just had to stop, but it was really sad, and it's still kind of, like, hard for me to watch, like, ballets and stuff, because I just, like, I get kind of like, like, what could have been? I mean, not that I ever thought I was going to be a professional dancer, because that, I feel like, is just so competitive and hard, but, you know, I would have liked to, I think, like, it's something I really miss a lot. And it's just not as easy to incorporate it as an adult. So, and to try to make time for that, and to find a studio and all these things. So, yeah, I was really, I did tap for a while. I did modern. I did a lot of different styles of dance, and ballet and jazz were probably my favorites. So I was able to stick with them for, yeah, quite some time.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So were you, like, performing? Were you?
Yeah, so performing, I was also on a competition team, which is funny because, like, there is a dance team at, you know, most high schools, and I wanted nothing to do with, like, the high school dance team. But I did really like, I'm really not that much of a competitive person, but I really liked that feeling of being a part of a team and being able to, you know, travel and go places and dance, basically, and then watch other people dance too. It was really fun and exciting. So I was a part of a competition team for a while, and that was a lot of fun. It was really exhausting, but, you know, I was still very young, so I had all that energy. So, yeah, I definitely liked doing that. And, yeah, it was a really great time in my life. So,
what kind of dance was that?
That was usually a mix of, like, jazz and modern. Not so much ballet, but I mean, everything kind of pulls from ballet, so I guess really it could have been all of the above, but mostly the pieces that we danced were jazz or modern, so, yeah.
Cool. And were you mostly, was that all through, like, one studio, or?
Yeah, that was through one studio, so it was first called Metro Dance way back when, and it used to be on University Avenue by Whole Foods, and then at the bottom of that, like, big apartment building. And then it changed to Ballet Madison, and so it really is now Madison Ballet Company or Madison Ballet, mm-hmm. but then they kind of branched off, and I went with one of the former directors, Carol Marion Cinetti, who is also an alum from here, I believe, and an alum from Middleton High School too, which is funny. but she started her own studio out sort of in Fitchburg. Oh my God, and I'm blanking out. Oh, it's, I think, Madison Professional Dance Center is what it's called. Yeah. So they branched off and I went with them and my other friends that way. So the whole time I stayed sort of with the same people, which was really nice. I wasn't a studio hopper. Like, I really liked being where I was. And they were all really supportive and fun. And so, yeah.
That's really awesome. is there anything else you want to say about dance or school?
I don't think so. I can talk more about school in terms of, like, my higher education stuff whenever we get to that.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that, yeah.
But, yeah, I think that's probably, for now, that's okay. Pretty much all of it.
Cool. So, going a little bit back to other parts of growing up. So, mm-hmm. You mentioned that your parents divorced, mm-hmm. and you lived in, like, Madison and Middleton.
Right.
Did you have any siblings or other family in the area?
Yeah, I have one older brother. He's 4 years older than me. And so he does not live here anymore. He's in San Francisco. But, so we grew up together. And, yeah, he's a fairly good older brother. So, you know, we always got along, and we get along even more now that we're both adults, and mm-hmm. so that's nice.
Yeah.
But he's pretty far, so I don't see him all that much. See him about once a year, but yeah.
And you write a lot about your, like, Italian-American mm-hmm. identity. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. Where to begin? So it became important to me, I think, I don't know, I began asking questions of my grandfather when I was pretty young about Italy and about him growing up and whatever, and he would never really want to talk about it because he just was like, that's the old country, and like, he was, you know, fully assimilated. His grandparents, my great-grandparents, came over from Calabria, which is the southernmost part before Sicily. And they came to Racine, eventually, Racine, Wisconsin. And so he was taught in school here to, you know, assimilate and speak English and all this stuff. So he, whenever I expressed interest, he like really didn't want to talk to me about it. I didn't understand because I was a kid and I was like, why don't you want to talk about this? But eventually he kind of changed because I think he, as the older he got, I think he did kind of miss sort of, you know, the culture and the things that he was really told to kind of get rid of and dismiss. And so he did start sort of talking with me about it and speaking Italian with me a little bit here and there. And then I eventually studied abroad in Italy. And so that kind of made things closer then too, because he wanted to hear all about that. And it's something that, it's been really important for me as sort of, just as an identity marker and, because of the, you know, I've always been really interested in genealogy. And so I'm the only one in my family who's really had that interest. And I've really like looked deep into our family history and things like that and, feel a really big connection with my ancestors in certain ways. And so I really love, it's probably the librarian in me. I really love like researching that stuff and, you know, like, it's like a puzzle trying to like find out like who came over when and how and what did they do and thinking about the lives that they lived, before they came here. And I think that Italian American culture, there's various difficulties with it. I self-published a book, an anthology on it, specifically for Italian American women, to sort of figure out and deal with and discuss a lot of the themes that would come up, and from food, of course, to, you know, sort of machismo and just patriarchy and things like that, and. So it's been important to me to sort of look into that and look through that, because I do feel very, very Italian American, and it's something that it resonates with me quite a bit. My name is very Italian. A lot of times I think too it was a way for me to answer people's questions when they would ask me, what are you? Which I would get a lot growing up. I got a lot in college from people who really, you know, it's like, you shouldn't say that. But so I would have to sort of be like, well, this is what I am. Like, you don't need to know, but okay. And so it really was sort of a guidepost for me to sort of be like, yeah, like, okay, this is what I am, like, and it's just, I think, generally been of interest to me, so, and then living there, too, for, you know, a short amount of time, 6 months-ish, just increased that, and, you know, I was at one point able to speak Italian fluently. I'm sure I can't anymore, but I, you know, that was really exciting and fun, and I connected a lot to that, so.
So what are some cool things that you found out about your ancestors?
That's a good question. Cool things. I don't know. I mean, I think, like, I love that there's so much access now to, some of these resources online, and I mean, I have an Ancestry.com account, of course, and like, it was just fun to see sort of like passenger listings of who's on the boat, you know, coming over here, and that's where I saw a couple of my my great grandmother, my great great grandmother, and my great grandfather. Saw their names, saw their signatures. That was really interesting and cool. I'm sort of stuck in finding out a lot more about them. So I kind of want to like hire somebody at some point, because I just feel like there's so much more I could figure out, but the records aren't there, or they're not where I'm looking. And my grandfather was just not a very sentimental person, and so he didn't really care to keep anything, or like we have photos and things, but you know, he was never able to really tell me like who's who, or like what did people do, or because again, he just didn't really want to talk about it for such a long time, and then he died, and so it was like, okay, well, that's all gone with him. So I'm still sort of constructing narratives, I think, about who a lot of them were. But I mean, I also, my dad really still can remember his grandma, who was from Italy, and but she, you know, didn't speak any English, and she lived in Racine, and just sort of, you know, hearing about that and hearing how isolating it must have been too, and to just not be able to speak the language everyone else is speaking. And I know there are people who are dealing with that to this day. And just, you know, it's like, how do you do that and survive? And, they were fairly poor. Yeah, so I'm still kind of like figuring out, I guess, about them. Personality-wise, they seemed very, for the most part, very happy people. and kind of, you know, they wanted to come here for the quote, you know, better life. And I really wish I could ask them, like, was it worth it? did that happen for you? Because I don't know, maybe they feel like it did, but it seems like they were fairly poor, you know, the entire time they were here. And it just seems like, you know, to leave everything you know and to come somewhere totally new and foreign. Was it worth it? And so I don't know. I'm still sort of looking into all of that in my free time. But I hope to learn more eventually.
Do you know what brought them to Racine?
I don't know, because I remember thinking, like, why would they settle in Racine of all places? I know that, well, so they came to Ellis Island first, and then they made their way to, I think they came to Kenosha, which they knew had a fairly high Italian population. They also were in Milwaukee for a short time, but I think they didn't want to be in a bigger city, so I think that's maybe why. And I think maybe getting a job might have been easy. I'm not exactly sure, but I think it was something about that. But because I was like, why? That's weird. How did they end up in Racine of all places? Because that's where my dad was born, and so they stayed there. You know, the family stayed there. I'm not exactly sure. So maybe that's something I will figure out at some point, hopefully. Yeah.
So we both know what Ancestry.com is, but we don't know how far into the future someone might listen to this.
Ooh,
so would you mind saying for the record what Ancestry.com
is and how you knew
about it?
Yeah. So at this point, Ancestry.com, who knows how it might change, is a database really sort of set up to help you search for your ancestors. They have, you know, birth records, marriage records, death records. Some of the features are paid, so you have to, you know, get a subscription. There is some stuff you can do for free, just doing a simple search of like an ancestor's name. But there's definitely a lot more you can do with the paid options, and, you know, find out various details. It's a website, basically. That's what it is right now. What was the other question you asked me about that?
How did I find out
about it? I think years ago I did some internet searches for genealogy help. And I think that was one of the, it wasn't as big as it is now, but it was still kind of like one of the bigger platforms to use. And so I was like, okay, like I'll try this. I've also used Family Search, which is another free site to look up ancestors. But that doesn't seem to have as good of or as many results. So I haven't used that one as much, but yeah, I came across them, I think, just years ago, because I've for a long time, since I was a kid, been really interested in genealogy. And then when I was here at school getting my second master's, I took a genealogy class, and I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. It's just always been something I've been into. So yeah, I kind of just figured it out through simple internet searching, I think. Yeah.
What do you attribute that interest to?
That's a good question. I think everybody, you know, is curious about where they came from to some extent. To figure out sort of historically, like who was before me and what were they like. I also think for those of us who are white, I think we have a very disconnected sort of, I don't know, feeling to our past and our ancestry. And I think a lot of white people desperately want to have some sort of connection to their past and to their ancestry, but there's not always a way to do it, or it's not, you know, it's kind of boring in some ways because it's just like the typical European, like, white people, okay, yay, like, what's exciting about that kind of thing. But I think for me, I kind of came into it because I just really felt like, so I'm not from a big family, and I wanted to always be from a big family. And so I think, you know, it's like I don't have a lot of people in my immediate family. And so kind of looking back and looking at people that are part of my family tree is really interesting to me, and seeing like all of those people who came before me and what they did, and you know, yeah, I think that's where that comes from. But I don't know, I'm kind of the only one in my family who's like that, so I don't know. I also think, I mean, I'm a very sentimental person too, so like I just am, yeah, really, yeah, like sentimental about everything, so maybe that is also why. I don't know.
I think it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you about Strega Nonnaria. Mm-hmm. We could also pivot and talk about when you went to Edgewood and then come back to Strega Nonnaria.
Stregaria?
Stregaria.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so we can talk about that. I mean, okay. I think, so that is, that is like, it's basically Italian witchcraft. Okay. Yeah, right? Who doesn't want that? And I came across it just like in my studies of like kind of feeling like I was interested in witchcraft, right? Like what teenage girl isn't? I don't know, especially in the 90s. And I mean, I knew that I had ancestors who sort of were healers in some ways, could be called healers in some ways, you know, sort of did medicinal, herbal, plant-based things. And so I sort of wanted to connect to that more in a way and read more about it. 'Cause it's not like that was something I could really ask my grandfather about, 'cause he wouldn't have known anyways. So I just started researching it and, you know, reading as much as I could about it, basically. And it's something that I don't have, like, a rigid practice of or anything, but it's something that, I mean, I kind of have made my own spiritual practice around. And I have an altar and things like that at home. And yeah, I don't know. It's funny because, of course, like, people always joke, like, with Italian culture, it always has to do with food, and like this too, like, has to do with food. That's like, there's some like a lot of like food sort of metaphors or, you know, practices that you can do with food and like things like that. And I don't necessarily do all of them or any of them, but it's, yeah, it's more of something to sort of, that I've started doing to sort of honor the women ancestors from my life. So
awesome.
Yeah. So
And how is Stregaria spelled? Is it S-T-R-E?
I need to look it up now because, okay, I'm like, wait, maybe There's two different spellings of it, because so the old way is Stregaria, which is Stregheria.
Okay.
But I think the sort of newer term is Stregoneria, which okay. Stregoneria.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Cool.
Just
thank you.
Looking at the Wikipedia definition cool. of that real
thank
quick.
You.
Yeah.
That will make it easier for whoever's transcribing.
Yeah,
this.
Sure. Yeah.
Cool. And how did you find out about your ancestors who were like healers?
Through stories, basically, from my dad and my grandfather a little bit, too. I mean, I think my grandfather was not talking about it like it was a good thing or a cool thing or anything. You know, it was like, ooh, witchcraft, like, stay away from that. Like, again, it was a way that he was trying to, like, distance himself from his culture and stuff. But so mostly through stories from family members, yeah.
Cool. And do you remember any of the books that were especially helpful when you were researching it?
Mm.
Or other sources that you might have found?
I mean, there are a lot of books actually out there. I mean, there's just one called Italian Witchcraft that I remember. That was maybe the first one I got. I got it from like a used bookstore when I was pretty young. And I think it's by Raven Grimisi.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot though, actually. I was kind of surprised. And there's even a lot of like people I follow on Instagram now who identify as that too. So it's like it's cool to pick up some things from like those people on social media as well. But I think that was the first book that I got and was super interested in. Yeah.
That must have been exciting to find in a used bookstore.
Yeah, it was. It was. I remember like, oh my God, this is magical, basically. Like, so yeah.
Cool. Well, you brought up Instagram. I was going to ask you about social media stuff later, mm-hmm. so we could talk more about that now, or we could get back to talking about like education and like Madison and.
Sure. Well,
I guess
I don't know. Which way do you want to go?
Well,
I could do either.
Why don't we, let's pivot back.
Okay.
So you mentioned that people, like when you were in college, would like ask you what you were. Was that mm-hmm. when you were at Edgewood?
Yeah. Yep.
Tell me about that.
So, I went to Edgewood. I was there from, 2004 to 2008. Went right after high school there, mostly because I didn't want to go to UW. I was too afraid because it was so big. And I also didn't think I could get in because, again, having been diagnosed with two learning disabilities and having been told I was stupid or not smart by teachers for a long time, you start to believe those things. So Edgewood was like the only place I applied to and I got in, and so I went there. This also kind of funny, sad thing about, so by the time I went to college, my grandfather, again, this is typical Italian American patriarchy, whatever, he paid for my brother's schooling, but not mine. So, I mean, he, I think, helped me a little bit. But, like, my brother was, like, completely paid for. And I had to take out loans. And, of course, Edgewood is a private college, so it was not cheap. Anyways, so I was there from 2004 to 2008. And it's a small campus, or it was then. I mean, I think it's still fairly, they like to keep it fairly small. I really liked it most of the time. I liked the smaller classes. I liked that I had sort of more one-on-one attention with professors. And I had some amazing professors there who actually made me feel like I was smart. And that was the first time in my life I had felt that way. So it was pretty intense and amazing for that to happen then. But there were, I mean, a lot of the people that go to Edgewood, or at least at that time, were people from very small towns in Wisconsin. And so, as you can imagine, small town Wisconsin, they've maybe never seen a person of color, I don't know, but people would consistently ask me what I was, like, are you black? Are you mixed? Like, very pointed, inappropriate, racist questions. And that was, I mean, that was like the first time that that had happened, really, and I was very floored by it and didn't know what to do. Because on the one hand, I was like, well, people don't have a right to know what I am. Like, fuck that, whatever. But on the other hand, I don't want people thinking that I'm, like, I don't want this to be like a Rachel Dolezal situation. I don't want people thinking that I'm, you know, trying to be something I'm not, or that I am something I'm not. So I would always make sure to, I always felt like I had to clarify, like, no, I'm not, like, I'm white. Like, I mean, I would say that. And then they, you could tell people sometimes were still like, but like, what kind of white? Like, you know? And so then, of course, I'd be like, well, I'm Italian. And so then that would be like, oh, okay. Like, because you have curly hair. Like, I don't know. It was really ignorant kind of stuff. So that was weird. I majored in English there. I had a fine arts grant scholarship for poetry. So that helped very minutely with with the tuition, but it was like, I don't know, it was like $1,000 grant or something. And so I, that was, you know, English was my major. Writing was the concentration I did. And I minored in women's studies, what was called women's studies then. And they didn't really have, I mean, I probably would have double majored in those two things, but they didn't have, they didn't really have a women's and gender studies program. It was like, you know, they had faculty from various departments teaching like about gender and women and et cetera. So yeah, I minored in that. And yeah, mostly really liked it, liked the classes I took, the professors, and you know, I had a fairly good time there. I do think that I got a good education out of it, so I don't regret going there or anything. And yeah, graduated then in May or June 2008. So.
So the poetry grant, mm-hmm. was that from Edgewood? Was that from
it? It was from Edgewood, okay. Yeah. Yep.
So you were writing poetry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still do. I self-published a poetry book in 2015. And I actually I published a chapbook in when I was a senior in high school as part of an independent study. So,
cool.
Yeah, it was momentarily sold at A Room of One's Own. For I don't know how much, but that was sort of, yeah. So I've written poetry for a long time. The first poem I ever wrote was about a cat. And so...
About your cat? Or
any? No, I've never had... My whole family's allergic to cats and dogs, except me. So,
oh, no.
Yeah. So it was always very sad. So I always wanted, I desperately wanted a cat or a dog always. But so I would write about things like that when I was a kid, of course. But yeah, I've written poetry for a long time. And so the grant was from Edgewood's English department, I believe. Yeah, specifically for poetry. So,
cool.
Yeah.
What were some of your favorite classes, instructors?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I can remember. I mean, Melanie Herzog, who I think is the chair of the art department there now, but has had previous different roles. She was a favorite of mine. Lainey Kavalosky-Prant was also a favorite of mine. I loved a lot of my English classes. I took one on fairy tales and horror stories. It was like really fun and interesting. I took, a women in art class that was really interesting as well. God, I don't know. What else did I take there? There were some really interesting classes that I took that I remember really liking. Most of my creative writing classes I really enjoyed, for obvious reasons, because of course. I hated math, of course, because I can't do it.
But you had to take a math class.
Yeah, requirement.
Do you remember what you took?
No. I mean, it was like Algebra 1 or something. I mean, it was whatever basic, like, I think I, like, got a C in it. It was, like, my one C. Like, it was like I could barely get through it, so. Science I had to take, too, and I was never really good at science. But I was always interested in science. I just couldn't really think in the ways that science needs you to think. I'm not a very logical person, and so I enjoyed some of those classes, but I just didn't do well in them.
What kind of science classes did you take? More like bio, more physics?
I think we had to take a geology one, actually, or something like that. We might have I don't know. I think I only had to take one, so I think it was something like geology. Which was interesting, but again, it's like I can't memorize information well, so
cool. And the women's studies classes, it sounds like the department was kind of just like cobbled together.
Not like it is at UW. Like there wasn't a full-fledged department. As a student job, I worked as a program assistant for the women's studies program for a while. And when I was there, we had a very small office, but like that doesn't exist anymore. Of course, it's like they took it away and gave it to like business or something. so there's not even like a physical space for the women's and gender studies program or department there. And yeah, there's never been like a, like it is here basically with like instructors who are really only teaching in this department and they all are in this department. It would really be like someone from English, someone from art, they'd take a class or do something. So
was there like a core group of students who would like take all the classes at least, or?
Yeah, I mean, they had a pretty good group of students, and retaining those students, because a lot of people, I mean, this was in the early 2000s, people were pretty interested in women's and gender studies still, or, at the time. And so they definitely had a good group of, like, I don't know how many students, but that was fun because when we had the physical space, we just would hang out there, and, like, that was really nice. And I mean, it couldn't accommodate that many people, but, like, there weren't that many, like, students, so it worked out.
Well, that leads into the next question I was going to ask about, like, extracurriculars.
Sure.
That can include unofficial things like hanging out in the gender and women's studies space.
Yeah, so I started the first feminist club on campus. I don't remember what year. And I don't totally remember the name of it either. It was like, it was sort of supposed to be modeled after a consciousness raising group. And we kind of like, I don't even remember how many times we met, but like we watched like a movie I remember once and sort of like dissected that and talked about that, and sort of the gender dynamics in it. So that was one thing.
Yes. Would you mind saying what a consciousness raising
class is? Yes, sure.
In case listening to this has not done their research.
Sure.
And doesn't know.
So consciousness raising group, those came out of the 70s. And really were started by women to sort of have these, at the time they were called, I think, women-only spaces, which is problematic because a lot of them were transphobic, which is not good. But they were designed to sort of have these spaces where women could connect and talk with each other about gender issues. So that's a very brief definition of it, but there's more to it than that. But yeah.
And when you formed this group, like, how did you decide to do that?
I think it was after talking with some other friends that were also sort of in, taking those classes and were interested. I think it was just a way to sort of like find community too and get to know people and hang out with like-minded people. Yeah.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Was there much of like a feminist community?
There was a little bit. There definitely was. It was small, but it was there, and I was a part of it. So at least while I was there, there was a little something. So that was fun. I remember, I think we got in trouble once because in the little program office we had set out condoms, and like, because Edgewood is a Catholic college, even though it's technically not, because it's not recognized by the Pope, it is, they call themselves a Catholic college. And so that was a problem, that we were like, we had free condoms available to people. We didn't remove it though. So mm-hmm. And nobody really came in there. So unless they like wanted to be in there. So, but that was something that was like, dealing with shit like that was interesting.
It seemed like you were going to talk about other extracurricular things that you were involved
with. Yeah. Let me see. What else was I involved in? I don't know. I mean, I really didn't do a whole lot of, well, I guess I was, this, I sort of was part of the newspaper, and I was part of the literary journal that came out of Edgewood. I was the managing editor my last year there. So I was in charge of that. And then I did write for the student newspaper as well sometimes, but more not an ongoing basis, sort of off and on I would do some reporting. A friend and I at the time did sort of an expose on how Edgewood was not abiding by the Clery Act, which is this law, this thing that is supposed to protect students, specifically with regards to sexual assault, sexual violence. Edgewood, we had found, was not logging correctly or at all people who were coming and going, or like, what's the word? Like, in the campus security logs, they were not filled out the way they were supposed to be filled out. And they also were not being transparent to the public about that stuff, and you're supposed to be. It's kind of a legal requirement. A friend and I did this pretty big article blasting that. I believe that they changed, because I think they had to because of the legal issue behind it. But it was a pretty big find, and I don't even remember how we came across it, but it was something we started to look into, because there weren't whisk alerts like we have here, where like if something's happening, there's a burglary or something, you get an email or a text to your phone from, you know, campus security saying like what's happening. We didn't have that at Edgewood ever, and there was never a way, an easy way to sort of find out like, well, what is happening? What's going on here? So that was kind of scary. Yeah. But so I mean, I believe that they have, yeah, changed their ways with that, hopefully. So they should. But
what was there any like fallout after your ex?
No, there wasn't actually. None that I believe, not that I can remember anyways. I was probably pretty lucky. I don't know. Like I, you know, talk about white privilege. Like I didn't really have, I wasn't worried about that, and I didn't have to deal with it. There wasn't any like, I mean, I think too, there wasn't really anything they could say, like the secured campus security, because they knew that they had fucked up. Like it was pretty, I mean, we had covered our bases before we like wrote this whole thing, because it was a front page story at the newspaper, the student newspaper. Yeah, so we made sure though that like what we were saying was like legit and factual, and we had evidence and shit like that. So I don't think that they could really, I mean, it was gonna look bad if they tried to like, you know, go around, like say that we were, I don't know, or go against us in some way. But so I don't, yeah, I really don't think there was much, if any, like fallout from that. But
but it seems like people took it seriously, probably.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, again, it's like, I don't know how many people were reading the newspaper, the school newspaper, but yeah, I think that it was taken seriously, and I'm pretty sure that we, let, like exec know about it too, because in case they don't read the school newspaper, because we're, you know, thought of that too. So kind of let them know like, hey, FYI, you might want to deal with this and like look into this more maybe, because it's a kind of a big deal. So, so yeah, it's not like that was the only place that we, you know, said anything, but yeah.
That's so, like really important.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Just uncovered and
yeah,
the whole thing. And
yeah, I have it somewhere, the clipping of it, but yeah, it's like, it was pretty, yeah, pretty interesting. Yeah. So,
and what about the literary journal? What, you said you were an editor.
Yeah. So I had written for it for most of the years that I was a student there. And then my senior year there, I was the managing editor, and, got to really sort of just decide like what should go in it, what shouldn't, what it should look like. You know, it was a mix of art and, poetry and like short creative pieces. So, yeah, it was fun. I liked doing that. Although, I mean, I like writing more than I like having to sort of put something like that together. So it was a good experience for me to have, but it's not something that I probably would want to do as a job, you know? But yeah, so I did that. Then the last, it was 2008 or 2007 to 2008, probably. Yeah.
Cool. Were there any pieces that you had in the literary journal that you were like really excited about? Were you excited about all of them?
I mean, I thought they were all really great. There were some really talented artists that I remember that, you know, went to Edgewood and had some really nice visual art in there and in color, which was a big deal because it's like expensive to get that for printing. but we had the budget for it somehow. Yes. Yeah, right. So, I mean, there aren't any like names or that I can recall, but like I remember feeling really proud of it, the final product. So.
And what about things that you wrote either that year or other years?
I had mostly, again, I was writing poetry, so I had some poems throughout. I mean, I think, I don't know, looking back, I kind of cringe because it's like, you know, your old poetry, like, it's, I don't think it was my best work, of course. It was the best I could do at the time, and I remember being proud of it at the time. So, yeah, I mean, I mostly would write fairly short poems, and about various things, really about anything. And yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's not something that I would be necessarily proud of now, but at the time I was like, this is awesome. Like, so that's, yeah, you know, that's how that works, I think, whatever. Yeah. So you grow up and you, you know, kind of get better at things, hopefully. So yeah.
One thing I wanted to come back to, people listening to this might not know who Rachel Dolezal is.
Oh, right, sure.
Would you mind saying who she is?
Oh, God.
Hopefully she won't.
I don't even know how to explain her. So Rachel Dolezal So she's a white woman, I'll say that. She constructed this image of herself, though, to pretend as though she was a black woman. She was head of the NAACP, I don't remember which branch, somewhere in the Pacific Northwest.
Somewhere in Washington, I think.
Yeah, okay, Washington, that sounds right. And until, like, she was kind of, you know, outed, I guess, as, like, a white woman pretending to be a black woman. And she's gotten a fair amount of fame for that, a book deal for that. And so, yeah, nobody... Well, I certainly don't want to be thought of as her, so right. that's why I would always tell people, like, no, look, this is what I'm white, okay? Just, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's who she is.
Thank you.
Yep.
And when you were at Edgewood, were you living in dorms or living at home?
A little of both. So the first year I lived on campus in the all-girl dormitory. Sophomore year, I lived off campus, more actually sort of on UW campus with some roommates. Junior year, I lived on campus. Oh God, where did I live? No. I lived on campus, I think, yeah, in the sort of like upper class housing that they have for a little while. And then I moved home because I had a really shitty roommate situation that I had to get away from. And then my last year, I lived sort of, I lived off campus, off of Monroe Street with a couple roommates. So, which that was probably my favorite because it's just like a nice area. So, and it's close. So,
what was it like moving into a dorm? You're still in the same familiar
city, yeah,
but you're like on a campus,
right,
starting college, also living in a dorm.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I think it was really good for me because I had never lived away from home before or been away that, you know, sort of like on my own in that way. But it was also nice to have that cushion of like, my parents both live in town and like I could go home whenever I wanted if I really want to. And I chose specifically to live in the all-girl dorm because it was the only dorm that had singles, and I didn't want to have like a roommate in my actual room with me because that just seems like too much. And because like we each got our own sink and like kind of area, so that was nice. So I really liked it. I was homesick, which is really funny because I was, I mean, in the same city as my parents. But I got used to it, and I would go home on weekends sometimes, but mostly just because like everybody at Edgewood would go home on weekends because mm-hmm. most people were from places in Wisconsin. And so it was really quiet and just like nobody was around to do anything. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll go home too. I think it was a really good experience to have like, you know, some independence, but also know I had this sort of fallback if I really needed it. Because that set me up really well then for when I, you know, decided to get my first master's degree and move to Chicago, because that was like, I would not have probably been able to do that, you know, as an 18-year-old. So that really helped me to be able to then do more of that in life and get used to it and like it and all of that. So that
totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. We just hit an hour.
Okay.
I know you said you had a meeting at some point.
Yeah, I have a meeting at 1.
Should we keep talking about education stuff, or does this seem like a time to pause?
We could maybe finish the education part. Does that work?
Yeah, that's okay. Good. So you just brought up moving to Chicago for mm-hmm. grad school.
Yep.
So you graduated Edgewood.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go right to grad school?
I did. So I started at DePaul University in Chicago in 2008. Yeah, fall of 2008. Right after undergrad. Mostly because the economy crashed and that was bad. And I also just didn't know what I was going to do with my life. So I was like, why not go get in more debt? I went to another private school and had to take out a bunch of loans. I did get a research assistantship there, though, which paid for half my tuition for the 2-year program that I was in. So that was nice. That was something at least. I went there for women's and gender studies, and it was really only the second cohort of that program.
Oh.
So it was still fairly new, so they were definitely working out some kinks, and it was not as good as it probably could have been, or maybe hopefully it's better now. I did really like a lot of the professors I had, the classes I went to and had,
And why DePaul?
So I just remember Googling like, you know, master's programs for women's and gender studies, and I didn't really want to go to UW for whatever reason. Also because I knew it was very competitive to get into their program here. I knew I wanted to leave Madison, but I also was like, I don't want to go that far. because I was like, you know, still kind of new to like getting out of here. So I looked at DePaul and I looked at Loyola, and I wasn't super into Loyola's program. At the time, it seemed kind of more like wanting to just sort of talk about dead white women who did some things and that was it. I wanted something different than that. So DePaul seemed like a better option for me, and I liked where it was located too in the city. That's why.
So how would you characterize their program? If Loyola was mostly about dead white women, DePaul was more...
I think it was more, I mean, there seemed to be more professors of color and more attention to marginalized communities, and not sort of this whitewashing of feminism that seems to happen everywhere. So that sort of drew me. There just seemed to be more, more and different things happening there, so.
And tell me more about, being in the second, like, cohort,
mm-hmm.
tell me more about, like, how they were still figuring out the program and, like, did it live up to your expectations?
I mean, one of my biggest issues with it was that there was really no attention to getting a job. Mm-hmm. And that's something I wish I would have looked into more or asked more questions about early on, because I didn't. But there really was not, there weren't options for internships. There weren't options to sort of, there weren't like job talks to go to, or like, you know, there really was no attention to that. And I had thought that I was in a pretty good spot because I was working closely with a professor there, two professors there. One had was no longer, I guess, teaching, but she was still sort of working for DePaul. I was working really closely with them, did a lot of work for them, and thought that they would help me out, and they didn't. And so, in fact, they kind of screwed me over in the end. Kind of like just took my work that I did and ran with it too. Mm-hmm. So that was not the best. And just like graduating from there then in 2010, really not knowing what the fuck I was going to do, because I really kind of had banked on their help in some ways, or at least networking, helping network with people mm-hmm. through them. And they didn't do that. So I think my biggest critique of the program at the time anyways was that there was just no attention to, like, what do you do with this degree? Like, what are you going to do after? Especially because I really didn't think I was going to do a PhD, and I didn't really want to. And so I guess, I mean, you know, it's like you can't, if you're not going to do that, then they didn't really talk to you about stuff. So I don't know. That was an issue.
So why didn't you want to get a PhD?
Because it just sounds miserable. I actually unknowingly applied to a PhD program, the feminist PhD program at Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I was like a finalist, but so it's funny because like my life would have gone in a totally different direction, potentially. Not totally different, but kind of. But I didn't want to, I think after going through the master's program, I was like, no, I'm done with school forever. This is awful. Like, it really beat me down. I was really kind of depressed throughout the whole time, just because grad school feels really isolating in a lot of ways. Writing a thesis feels just very isolating and not fun. And so I was like, I can't imagine a freaking a dissertation. Like, I just cannot do that. I will not do that to myself. So that's mostly why. And I also knew I didn't really want to be a professor. And I feel like, you know, if I really wanted to be a professor, then yeah, that would be the route to do that. But I didn't want to do that. So why spend more money? I guess I could have tried to, get, you know, funding, but I just really, it was just not going to be something that I would have wanted. Mm-hmm. So.
So tell me about the research that you were doing for those professors.
So we were researching the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and the coalition encompasses various domestic violence shelters throughout the state of Illinois. So places in Chicago, places in Springfield, Evanston, throughout. So I was conducting oral histories and transcribing them with a lot of the sort of leaders of a lot of these programs, or like women who started the programs, who maybe weren't involved with them anymore, but who had created them, really. So it was a very interesting project, and a book was supposedly going to be coming out about it, but who knows? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that ever happened. I don't know if my name is ever going to be anywhere on that stuff, but I did a shit ton of work for it. So it was roughly about that. And
Would you like to say the names of those professors? Sure. You are totally allowed to.
Okay. Sure. Dr. Irene Beck, who I really liked, And then Dr. Beth Catlett, who was also my advisor at DePaul, who I did not enjoy. I mean, just, you know, to be perfectly honest, it was a situation where she, as an advisor, she was just very terrible because mm-hmm. she was spread too thin and was not advising me. So, you know, I'm sure she would have been great had she had the time to advise me, but she didn't. And so it just was not a good fit. But then I also worked with her and Dr. Irene Beck on this other project then too. So
how did you get that? Was this your like research assistantship?
Yeah, I applied for it mm-hmm. and got it. So,
And was that your first time doing like oral history?
Yep. Yeah, it was. Yeah. So it was somewhat new to me, I guess, but, I mean, I had interviewed people before when I would do, like, reporting mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So that part of it wasn't super new, and I was comfortable doing that stuff. First time transcribing, though, and I hated that because it's just so, I mean, you know, it's hard. Yeah. And it takes a lot of work to do that. But, yeah.
What were some... Was there anything about the program that you did really like or any?
Yeah, I mean, I had a couple professors, Dr. Ann Russo, who is amazing, Dr. Leila Farah, who's also amazing, probably others too that I really like that I'm forgetting, and then classes that were really interesting and great as well. So, I mean, I don't regret my time there at all. I think it was a big learning experience, and I am happy that I have that degree. I feel like I can, you know, apply that knowledge to anything. So, I'm good with it. Yeah.
What did you write your thesis on?
My thesis was on I'm trying to think of like how I worded it exactly. The ineffectiveness of restraining orders within domestic violence contexts. So really looking at how using a restraining order or telling someone to just get a restraining order is ineffective and has shown to be ineffective, especially as just doing that as the only thing you're doing. I argued that it was important to have one just for... to have something documented, but beyond that, it's not gonna help much. If somebody wants to kill you, they're gonna kill you. And so, yeah, it was very uplifting work that I was doing. I decided to do it on that since my research assistantship was kind of talking about that as well, and so they kind of both talked to each other. So that's sort of how I came to... you know, deal with that subject matter specifically. It was a really interesting time though too, because my mom at the time had a stalker. Mm-hmm. She used to be a therapist, and it was a former client of hers who had been stalking her. And so it was interesting because I was sort of helping her in some ways too, and trying to find information for her, and resources for her. And telling her everything that I would come across and learn. And she knew from personal experience that, you know, yeah, it's like she's had restraining order before, and it's like, he came back, like it doesn't matter. And so luckily, you know, nothing has happened to her, but it was a very, it was really interesting how that all kind of lined up at the time. It was hard since I was in Chicago and she was here and living alone. And so I was really constantly kind of worried about her. So writing that thesis just had a lot of like personal stuff then too that I would be thinking about, and like reading all these case studies about, you know, really awful things that happened to people, and thinking about my mom. Yeah, it was a lot. So yeah. I was like very glad to be done with it when I was done with it, and to just really kind of not interact with it for a long time, if ever again. So yeah.
How did you take care of yourself during that time? Like that sounds like so
much. I mean, I don't think I did. Yeah. I think that's the thing too, is like in grad school, especially it was my first grad program. I think there's a part of you that thinks like, I can do this, I can take it, whatever. And you don't always know that it's eating away at you or that it's not healthy or something. And so, and because, you know, you're kind of stuck in just this like work mode, like I have so much shit I gotta get done. Like I don't have time to feel my feelings about it, which is not healthy. But I think that's kind of how I just like, I mean, I remember walking a lot and going for long walks a lot and like trying to take some yoga classes here and there and doing stuff like that. But, you know, not as much as I probably really needed to, or like I was not good at taking breaks and things like that. So, so I think, I mean, looking back, I'm like, I don't know how the hell I got through that, but thankfully that time is over with. So yeah.
Were you able to like find community at DePaul or elsewhere?
Yeah,
in
a little bit. Yeah. I was part of a feminist group there, mm-hmm. of course, did some activism, helped coordinate Take Back the Night at DePaul. And
would you mind saying what Take Back the
Night
is?
Yes, of course. So Take Back the Night is, it's an annual march protest that is put on by a lot of college campuses as a way to talk about sexual violence. So I was involved in that for a couple of years. Had some really gross like run-ins with the Chicago police, mm-hmm. where they just were very victim blaming and gross. And
in response to Take Back the Night,
yeah, just like saying you shouldn't drink that much then if you don't want to be assaulted and shit like that. So, yeah, so it was very eye-opening, and also not, because like it's like I had heard shit like that too before, so whatever. But there was a really nice community there, and especially since I was in a full-fledged women's and gender studies program, there were about like 15 in my cohort, so like we all kind of would hang out and you know do stuff and whatever. So so there was always the ability to get involved with something. So that was really nice and fun. The only issue was like, you know, not wanting to like take the train like a long ways away or something, or like if, you know, I just feel like, oh my God, everything's so far away. Like, do I really want to go out tonight and meet up and do this or what? I don't know. But otherwise, yeah, it was really great to have that sense of community, and yeah, not just in the classroom but outside of it too. So yeah.
And what did you do for fun?
Oh God. I mean, I mostly went to like shows, listened to music and stuff like that, went out to eat a lot because there's such good food there. Missed the food in Chicago. Hung out with friends, did yoga, things like that. So
any shows that really stand out? I feel like if I'm like a future researcher listening to this, like,
yeah, you'd want to know.
I would totally want to know what kind of music you listen to.
The Gossip came and performed, and I got to meet Beth Ditto. So I got a picture with her, so that was probably one of the highlights. I saw Mira. That was really awesome. And that was like at a smaller place too, so it felt really intimate and like not, you know, in a huge like she was so far away from me or something, so that was exciting. Who else did I see? I don't know. I think those were the two standouts.
Cool.
But yeah, so I mean the music scene's really cool. Oh, I saw the Coat Hangers, which I really liked. And yeah,
Cool.
So.
I have more questions about your time in Chicago, but it's close to 12:30.
Yeah.
So.
Should probably end. Yeah.
Yes. So we can end for now.
Okay.
I forgot to say, I think I was supposed to say it at the beginning, but this has been Samantha Garlock talking to LaCrista Greco on January 15th, 2020, and we are stopping part one now. Recording. Okay, so today is Friday, January 24th at about 11:10 a.m. This is Samantha Garlock with LaCrista Greco. And if you could
say something.
Let's see. Yeah, if you can just like say your name just so we can make sure
this is LaCrista Greco. It's a snowy day today in Madison. Quite cold, I think, too. Maybe not as cold as it has been, but somewhat chilly outside.
Okay, I think that sounds
was that good?
Good?
Okay.
Yeah,
I was like, I don't know what else to say.
No, that's great. Okay, so when we left off in part one, mm-hmm. we were talking about when you were living in Chicago for grad school.
Right, right.
And I believe that's when you started Guerrilla Feminism.
Yes. Nice segue.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if I would love to talk about like how that got started, what the inspiration was.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I started that in 2011, I believe. I was doing a year of AmeriCorps in Chicago, and I had a really awful supervisor who just made the job a living hell. And I was a year out of my graduate program, the first graduate program anyways, and I had really missed kind of just being able to discuss issues related to social justice and feminism and things like that with my previous grad cohort. So I really kind of missed that camaraderie and those spaces. So I kind of just started to print off and create these little images that had like different slogans or sayings or visuals. One, for example, was from an issue that Ms. Magazine did. The cover of the magazine I remember very vividly because it was very striking. It just said, "Rape is rape." And that issue I remember was all about not placing sexual violence in hierarchies, basically, and, you know, talking about how, like, rape is rape, whatever, however that sexual violence occurs, one is not, there's not a form that's worse than the other, and so that whole thing. And so I used that specific image for some of these placards that I created and put them around the city of Chicago, and would sometimes watch people interact with them or not interact with them. And that was always kind of interesting. And did that for a while. And then I wanted to get more people involved outside of just like my friend group. So I created a Facebook page for this thing, and I called it Guerrilla Feminism, in part sort of as an homage to the Guerrilla Girls, the feminist art group. But also because of just the word and the terminology of guerrilla being this like powerful sort of resistful kind of word and term to me. So did that. And the initial goal was to sort of get people to create feminist flyers and things like that, or get sort of some visuals out into various communities to sort of educate the masses on feminism and different social justice issues. So people would send in some pictures of the things that they posted or the signage that they created. I think the first group of people who did this that I remember seeing were in Scotland, maybe, or somewhere international. So it was pretty cool that like it had already, within a very short time, reached international spaces. So, and then the page kind of blew up really quickly and got a lot of follows and likes, which is, you know, social media currency. It kind of transitioned into a space for feminist news, social justice news, posting articles written by marginalized people primarily, or artwork as well.
And this was when it was still a Facebook page.
Yeah. And it still is a Facebook page. Yeah. But it's, so I think now currently, as of today's date, it has 150,000. It's funny because it's, at one point in time, that was really like, that was the largest following. In 2013 around, I created an Instagram, another social media platform, but more of a visual social media platform. I created an Instagram for guerrilla feminism. It was initially called Guerrilla Feminism. I changed the name to The Guerrilla Feminist so people would sort of stop thinking it was a collective, because it's just me now. And I'll kind of talk more about sort of how that came to be as well. But that actually has surpassed the Facebook page and did so pretty early on. I think also just because Instagram is kind of more popular currently. But that one has 220,000 followers as of today's date. Nice. Yeah, so the Facebook page was initially just me, and then I brought on a friend who was in my same grad program but a year ahead of me. So she helped with like moderating comments, blocking trolls, you know, or posting things as well. Then she kind of couldn't do it too much anymore. And then we kind of decided to create more of a collective and brought on some more people. And that was interesting, but a lot of work. At one point in time, guerrilla feminism had, I should remember the number, but something like maybe 50 branches. So there was like a guerrilla feminism India, a guerrilla feminism Switzerland, guerrilla feminism Texas. Like there were all of these different branches started by people. And so I was sort of overseeing about 80 volunteers online, people I had never met. We had a private Facebook group where I would kind of try to impart guidance and some sort of rules or regulations so that we were all consistent. But it got really sticky really quick. It got really kind of just... and also during this time, guerrilla feminism became a registered nonprofit for about a year or two, partially because I was gifted by some white guy. And it's important that I note that, because I mean, that's just, you know, funny that a white man would do this, but it's awesome. So a white man gifted me like $18,000 at one point for guerrilla feminism. And so with that money, I was like, okay, I should maybe turn this into something, because I don't know like what to do with that.
So I assume that was not an anonymous donation then?
It was not. I mean, I don't remember his name, but he had emailed me, and he didn't want anything out of it. He was just like, I came into this inheritance, I thought I should do something good with it. So here, and I was like, okay. there were no rules or stipulations on how to use that money. So with that money, I went to a lawyer and I made it a nonprofit, which took a lot of money, mm-hmm. Which I did not know. And so this was at the time where GF had all these branch pages and all of these moderators and people I was overseeing. And it was really, it was great for a while. And then it's just, you know, a lot of different personalities and the fact that we all had to communicate online with some video calls or things like that, but largely online in text. And it was basically a full-time job that I just could not do anymore, especially with no pay. And I had a full-time job, so that did pay. So I kind of had to, after a couple of years, decide what was best for myself and for the rest of, like, the people on my core team, as well as just, you know, the volunteers too, who were running the branches. And so I decided to cease it as a nonprofit, and then it, you know, became just an LLC, which is apparently the thing to do when you're closing out a nonprofit. That's what my lawyer said to do anyways. So it's back to being just me, which I actually am much more comfortable with. I've had a lot of issues with bringing people on initially and not knowing them and not having, and also just not having the experience initially of, you know, how to work with people online and how to collaborate and how to manage people remotely and things like that. So there was just a lot of, I think, infighting and tension. And I mean, that is a big thing that happens in a lot of feminist spaces, unfortunately, which is why in some ways feminism doesn't get a lot of shit done. So it kind of just went from there. And so I spend a lot more time on the Instagram page these days than I do on the Facebook page, though I do try to share things on the Facebook page, but the Instagram page is definitely more popular.
So
that was a lot that I threw at you. So
okay, so it started, you're in Chicago, you're done with grad school.
Yep.
What was the AmeriCorps job that you were doing?
So that was through, what was it? It was like through the literacy, Illinois literacy specialists or something like that. I was placed at a nonprofit that I really loved, actually, called Annixter Center in Chicago. And they do a lot of different things for adults with disabilities. They have a day program for adults with disabilities. So I was a literacy specialist there. I taught some of these adults. I managed the volunteer tutors who would come in and sort of do one-on-one tutoring with the adults. I really liked working there. And once my horrid supervisor quit, it was just like night and day how much different that was and how much better it was. But they do a lot of great work, and I really enjoyed working there. So
it was while you were working there with your awful supervisor that you started, was it posters or what was it that you were putting around?
It was like, it was laminated, small sort of like 4x6 or smaller sort of like placards.
Okay.
Things that could fit into like a wallet or... So not quite posters. Mm-hmm. I was kind of trying to be somewhat subtle,
mm-hmm.
but also wanted to have something somewhat nice that people could actually take if they liked it or if they wanted to. And I didn't put like my name on anything or GF's name on anything at that time. It was very just kind of like just putting this stuff out there and seeing if people connect with it or not. So,
And so it started just you, and then did you get some of your former cohort involved?
Just one friend, just basically, one. Yeah, who helped initially, and then a few more people from just people I knew, friends and stuff. We had a website for a while. It was, I think, gorillafemme.com because Kathy Brennan, a very transphobic feminist, in quotes, and lawyer, bought the domain name gorillafeminism.com just to try to fuck with me. So because GF was very trans-inclusive and is still very trans-inclusive. So I had blocked her from the Facebook page at one point, and she, this is how she took out her anger, I guess. So I couldn't purchase that domain name, but that was fine. I eventually purchased gorillafeminism.org once it was a nonprofit, and we had this website. We initially kind of tried to do like an online magazine. That was really hard because, again, I was like kind of the only person doing the bulk of the work. We would get really some really good submissions, but I had to do all the editing. I did all the uploading, all the formatting for the WordPress website. I spent a lot of just probably 40 plus hours a week on all of it, you know, and I was not getting paid. So, and I had a full-time job that was paid, so, and other responsibilities. So
tell me more about how it felt when it started to first like blow up and there was like international interest.
It felt really cool, to be honest. I mean, it was what I had set out to do. I wanted it to be beyond myself and beyond the US. Yeah, it still is really cool, but it was slightly overwhelming, I think, too, at the how quickly it grew. But I mean, it was really clearly it was fulfilling some sort of need or something that people connected with. And I mean, I continue to hear that to this day. I have followers who followed me from the beginning. Which is really interesting and really sweet to hear. But also it's something I don't think about in terms of follower count as much, or that wasn't ever the, purpose of it. Especially because at the time, like Facebook was still, I was still fairly new to Facebook and like, I mean, I don't really care that much about it. I was just like, well, it's an online platform, so I can, it's like easier to reach, you know, a lot of people at once. But I wasn't like, okay, I gotta get followers, I gotta do this. And I think because I wasn't so into that part of it, it kind of just organically was able to happen. And I think too, people resonated with the authenticity of the page and of what was posted. So it's been really great to hear, but it's also kind of like seeing those numbers of followers just as like, I don't know, it's like hard to compute, you know, mentally. And like, I'm just like, I don't know, like those are real people. What? Like, it's just a weird like thing. So
I bet.
Yeah. But it's super awesome. Yeah. So yeah.
So maybe in the future, feminist groups will not have so much infighting.
Right.
And they won't know what we're talking about.
It's true.
So tell me more about some of the, like, conflicts. Like, you don't have to get, like, you can get as specific or be as vague as you want. But, or just, like, themes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know. There are so many different, quote, types of feminism. And I think, too, what I primarily am talking about is the fact that there are, like, transphobic feminists, in quotes, feminists, because I don't really find them to be actual feminists, but or, you know, just, or sex worker exclusive feminists as well, what we call SWERFs. So it's like those two things primarily is kind of what I think about and what I wish would change. I mean, I clearly would like those people to actually get on the right side and not be, you know, exclusive to trans people or sex workers. But that's, you know, and that's, it's unfortunate that that's still such a hill to die on for some of those people. And that, you know, they're so bigoted that they just can't even see or don't want to see the reality of it all. And, you know, I've been called, you know, a man hater, of course, but I've been called a woman hater too, by TERFs, because trans exclusionary radical feminists, because of my stance of, you know, trans women are women and trans men are men, et cetera. And so it's like that kind of infighting. I mean, at this point, so initially I would try to educate those people really early on, and it would be really exhausting and end up nowhere. So at this point, I don't really do that. I spend more time talking with people who are trans and who are sex workers and et cetera, and like making sure that the spaces I create online and offline are inclusive for the most marginalized people. And if that's going to make, you know, some white lesbian radical feminist uncomfortable, then tough shit, you know? So that's the kind of infighting that it's like, well, you know, it'd be great if we could all, like, actually, you know, understand that, like, oppression is bad, like, all oppression. So, but some people are a bit slow on the uptake. So I don't know what that's going to take to sort of change that or what. But that's something that I, you know, and also just the fact that, like, white women are still very front and center in feminism. And so that's something I've tried to do too with, like, this platform I have now, because I have this large platform, to really share voices that are not mine, especially women of color, trans women of color, you know, people who are more on the margins and don't get their voices heard.
So you, I don't remember if you just said it now, but you've mentioned the word troll. So,
yeah. Should I define that?
Maybe define that. And also, tell me how you know if someone is a troll. Mm.
Well, so what I mean by a troll, that's very internet lingo for, like, somebody who, in feminist spaces, it's typically a young white man, a young white cis man, who just comes onto your online page to fuck with you, basically, and doesn't care about anything other than, like, it's entertainment for them. They can be very abusive, although most of the times trolls are kind of just, like, just annoying. And for me, I mean, that's, I've blocked, I don't even know, hundreds of thousands of people probably in the span of, like, the 8+ years I've been doing this. Yeah, I sort of think of them differently as compared with, like, being cyberbullied, because trolls, they usually are somewhat harmless. They're just really annoying, but cyber bullies are really scary and are a bit more aggressive, I think. And I mean, I've received rape and death threats from people like that before. And so, like, trolls, it's more just like making the, like, you know, typical like anti-feminist joke from the 1970s, like, you know, get back in the kitchen, like, make me a sandwich. Like, okay, like, that's all you have to say. Okay. So that's like, I mean, I get that exact thing, you know, in my spaces, even in 2020. So, yeah, that's kind of what I mean by trolls. And yeah, I mean, I mostly just block them right away because there's no point in even trying to have a conversation, or they don't care. And they're usually like 15-year-old boys, and they don't, you know, I don't know. So I try not to spend a lot of time with them.
And with the TERFs and SWERFs, how yes. do you, like, how do you know if they're, like, trolling or what? Like, how do they reveal themselves, and how do you know when to block them?
Oh, God. Well, with TERFs and SWERFs, it can be a little bit more difficult because, you know, you won't necessarily know until you post something about that's, like, sex work positive or trans positive or whatever. So I typically won't always know until that happens. And then if they post something that's like, you know, there are only two genders, or, you know, just explicitly like trans women aren't women or things like that, or, using for SWERFs, using the term prostitute, because really, I mean, that term has been reclaimed by certain sex workers, and so they're free to use that term in many spaces. But when someone who is not a sex worker uses it, it's very derogatory. So, like, that's kind of a clue to, you know, that, okay, this person is probably a SWERF, or if they just, you know, constantly are talking about human trafficking and don't understand the difference between human trafficking and sex work, and sort of conflate the two. Which is something I see a lot of. That's also kind of a clue. Some people might do that stuff just because they just don't know or they're ignorant. And so I can kind of tell with the way they word some of their stuff, but it's really easy to tell if they just don't care and they just are like, you know, no, I'm not, these people are awful or whatever. So it's easy to just block those people right away. Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. And so with the international and just the other branches mm-hmm. of guerrilla feminism.
And those don't exist anymore.
Those don't exist anymore. I was going to ask yeah. if you know if anything became of those groups.
So when I shut down GF as a nonprofit, I kind of shut down all the branches too, because it was too difficult to get people to be consistent, and the fact that they were using like something I created, the logo for the thing I created, all of these things, it really fell under me if they were to do anything that I didn't agree with, and so I felt really uncomfortable with that. And I initially had access to all of their Facebook pages, so I was like, it was required that I was added as like an admin in the back end. And they just had branch pages on Facebook, not on Instagram. One group in particular, GF Canada, decided to go rogue and tried to like kick me out, basically, of their admin area of their Facebook page, and they changed the name of it, and they, you know, and they got all these followers because of the name, and so it really pissed me off. And so I had to, like, I mean, I contacted Facebook, and I ended up getting the page back and was able to delete it. Because, again, I was like, you can start, you know, your own page or whatever, but, like, you got these followers because you used my name and my associations, etc. And also, they just were really shitty about it. So I was like, I'm not gonna, like, I did end up, I think, with GF Deutschland. They, because they had like talked with me and asked me, like, can we keep this page and we'll change like the name and we'll say, you know, this was previously attached to guerrilla feminism, but it's no longer, whatever, which is also just like really good for archival purposes, right? Like, yeah. as librarians, like, hello, and you should do that anyways. And so they were really respectful about it, and I was like, yeah, sure, like, do that. It's not that I'm like, I don't want you to have those followers. Like, it was really just about, like, how the way GF Canada specifically just kind of went and did this behind my back and were really disrespectful about it. And I'm sure they feel that I was disrespectful about it, whatever. But, yeah, so it's unfortunate that some things ended poorly between myself and some of the branch managers. But... yeah. Others, though, we had sort of these agreements. So, yeah.
And were there, like, ideological differences, or was it mostly just the kind of, like, interpersonal conflict that can come up?
Yeah, it was mostly, mostly interpersonal. I don't think there were ideological differences, although it was interesting to see sort of what some of the international pages would post, because some of the stuff was a little questionable in terms of, like, ideologies, I think. And I mean, I can't pinpoint any specific thing, but, like, it was hard to sort of not be US-centric and know that, like, okay, things are different, like, here and in these other spaces, but also, like, you know, we need to be somewhat consistent, specifically with our ideologies, like, I don't necessarily like to call GF a brand, but it really kind of is. And so, you know, you kind of have to, if you have branch pages, it's like, you know, Planned Parenthood has a Planned Parenthood Wisconsin, Planned Parenthood Illinois, et cetera. Like, that's just, it's easier for people, for users, to, you know, like, okay, like, this is a legitimate, like, you know, association with this bigger organization. And so some people just didn't, or, you know, didn't want to do that or couldn't do that. Or, and I was sort of just exhausted from trying to kind of, like, police all of the branch pages, and, like, I had to, like, kind of, you know, look over all of them to make sure they weren't posting, like, really weird shit, or, like, you know, like, transphobic shit, or, like, and I needed to be available to people if they had issues, or, like, if they had followers who were questioning why they posted something, or, like, it was just, you know, it was just too much for one person, especially when it was not paid. So yeah, that's kind of, I guess, what I mean by that. But yeah.
Yeah.
It's making me tired just thinking about it. Well, I'm like, oh my God, how did I do that for, like, so many years?
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, it's interesting to think back to.
Yeah. I was just about to pivot to when you
were, I mean, it's
Wisconsin.
Okay if you have other questions about it. It's fine, too.
Is there more that you would like to say about guerrilla feminism in its early days?
I don't think so. No, I mean, it brought me a lot of awesome opportunities. Like, I mean, that's when I started, you know, being brought to publicly speak at different colleges and universities around the U.S. So, and I've met a lot of awesome people. Yeah, so, I mean, that's all been really great and exciting and made all of the bad shit really worthwhile. So, yeah.
What were some especially memorable opportunities, like speaking engagements or...?
Well, I think my first one ever from that was I was the keynote for Women's History Month at University of Rochester in New York. And this was in... Ooh, I think it was 2013, actually. So it was really just based off the Facebook page at that point. And that was really exciting. And, you know, they flew me out there. I was there for like 24 hours. It was a, you know, real quick trip. But I got to, you know, meet and hang out with the students and who brought me and that, you know, talk to a fairly large audience. And since then, I've talked at other universities as well, and that's still something I really love doing. And yeah, so that was probably the first thing. The other thing that it's just kind of funny because this is sort of how Instagram is, where, you know, celebrities try to sell you things, right? Well, people reach out to me to try to sell, to be like, would you like create an ad for us on your page and we'll pay you, which is a very wild thing to me. And like, I don't do a lot of them, but I do some of them. It depends on like what they are. And so I've, you know, worked with this sex toy company for a couple. And so it's weird to think I get paid for that. Like, that's really wild. I don't endorse anything that I don't actually like. So like, you know, yeah, that's also kind of a weird opportunity that I've gotten from this whole thing. I also, got a literary agent from having the Instagram page too, which really was based on because I have a following. So, I mean, it's, you know, that's what that is. So, but it's still really cool. So, yeah.
How did it feel to get the first request to speak at an event?
Exciting and then just very nerve-wracking. I mean, as an adult, I've always enjoyed public speaking. I hated it when I was in high school and middle school and even in college. But I don't know, once I hit like 25, I just got really into it or something. So yeah, like receiving that request was just really exciting. I also didn't know what the fuck I was doing though, like in terms of like negotiating or like how much money I was owed for something like that. So I did it for significantly less than what I probably should have, but, that's fine. So I was not a seasoned speaker at that point. I feel like I'm a seasoned speaker now. So, yeah.
And your literary agent, we can come back to this or we can talk about it now. I was going to ask about the works that you've published.
Okay.
So obviously you were like writing the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Then, off and on, I guess. Yeah.
We can talk about, would you rather talk about this now or when you came back and started working at UW?
I don't care. Okay. Whichever you think, however it goes better, if that matters, I don't know.
Let's see. Well, okay, so chronologically.
Yeah, chronologically.
So you started Girl of Feminism, you're in Chicago.
Right.
You finished your AmeriCorps.
Yes, and then I had a job for like 5 months that I got fired from.
Oh no.
A call center job that I didn't know was going to be a call center job. And it was for a very horrible company who basically had us, you know, it was sort of one of those things where you're chained to your desk. And if you leave, I mean, I was questioned by my supervisor at the time, like, why do you go to the bathroom so frequently? And I was like, because I want to stay hydrated and not get like a UTI. Thanks. Shout out to Wise Aunt Tutoring in Chicago. That was a horrible experience, toxic working environment. I was very traumatized from that whole thing. So got fired because they claimed my personality was not a fit, whatever. And I stayed in Chicago for the next several months trying to find a job, couldn't find anything. Had to move home, which is why I moved back to Madison in 2012. Got a few different jobs. Worked at my former high school for a year and a half, Middleton High School, as a special education assistant, which was a very interesting position, but also just very exhausting. And weird to be at my old high school in like an authoritative position. And then I, you know, I had been looking for a job because I was like, I can't do this forever. And also the pay was awful. And I found this position listed at UW in the Office of the Gender and Women's Studies Librarian. And I applied and I got it. So that's sort of how. And then I started here January 2014. So this is the longest I've been at any job that I've held. So, yeah.
What do you remember about the application and interview process?
I mean, I remember meeting with Joanne Lehman, one of my coworkers, and Carla Strand, my supervisor, who's the actual librarian in the office. I think it was just the two of them who interviewed me. I was up in the office, Memorial Library 430, and they just, yeah, we had our interview. I really liked both of them. I liked the space. I had never heard of the space before and came to find out that that was fairly typical, unfortunately. But I was like, I can't believe this exists. This is awesome. I felt like I could actually use my first master's degree, kind of, because it was also in women's and gender studies. And it was an operations associate position, so it wasn't, you know, I don't know, it's like kind of a glorified secretary position is what I tell people, even though, like, secretary positions are really hard, so, like, you know. But that's what the position was and is, but I do quite a lot of different things, so that's been exciting. And the work environment was like such a big part of me wanting to work here, really, because, you know, I had just come from the high school, which was like okay work environment, but then that experience at Wyzant in Chicago was horrible and was so traumatic for me that I was really scared to take a new position and just sort of, you know, and work somewhere new and see, like, you know, is this going to be as bad as that or what? And it's been night and day. It's, you know, I don't cry every day after work, which is amazing. You know, it's like just that alone is amazing. I like working in, you know, a smaller unit within a bigger unit. So being a part of the general library system and being part of Memorial Library is really great. And then also just being able to be in our own sort of closed off unit as well. I like that. So it's been really good. Yeah.
How has the role evolved since you started? Like, what were some of the things that you were mostly doing when you started? Mm-hmm. What do you do now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still doing quite a bit of the same things, but I've taken on a lot more tasks as well. So I've gotten quite a few raises, so that's been nice. And because I've taken on more work and more specialized work, so I work more on some digital projects, which is really fun and exciting, especially as I've been like making my way through library school. I get to create some lib guides, library guides, for those who don't know, like to help students with research purposes, and bibliographies as well. So doing some sort of librarian-ish duties has been really exciting and something that Carla, my supervisor, has been really just amazing about is, you know, letting me do some of that stuff. So I've also I started a couple years ago, 3 years ago maybe, supervising our student workers. So that was a new thing that was added to my position. I really like doing that. And then there's, yeah, still a lot of, you know, quite a bit of stuff that similar to when I started, just sort of, you know, answering the phone, being the first point of contact when people walk in, because I'm like the first desk you see. And scheduling staff meetings, things like that.
Who typically comes into the office?
A lot of different people. I mean, majority our students. We've had a lot more undergrads, though. The office has been around for 40-some years, and in the past, it has been more focused on graduate students, specifically graduate students within the GWS program here. But when Carla started, she started just a couple months before me, she started in 2013. She, I think, wanted to be able to provide access and support for anybody, which I think is really great. And so we get a fair amount of undergrads, actually, probably maybe even more undergrads than grad students, who come in just wanting research support and help. Sometimes they just walk in, which is fine, and people can do that. Other times I know they email Carla directly. So that's kind of, mostly that's the sort of type of patron we have. We do have some community members that I think come in, but that's kind of rare. Some faculty as well come in, specifically to talk with Carla if they're researching something within gender and women's studies.
Tell me more about the bibliographies and library guides you
have. Yeah, so they're all on our website, our office website, and Carla maintains a lot of them. I've only created a couple, but there was one that we've noticed got a lot of popularity on Puerto Rican women and sterilization, forced sterilization. And so that's been really interesting because the initial bibliography for that was created by, I don't remember her name, somebody that was not in our office, but somehow affiliated years ago. And then I did sort of an update to it and added some more resources that were a bit more current. So that's one of the guides that's been really popular and gotten a lot of clicks on our website. I know Carla worked on working on one about Black women in the suffragist movement, since, you know, the suffragist movement has been very focused on white women, and so she's trying to sort of bring more awareness to Black women and women of color during that time, and who did a lot of great work too. So so they're all housed on our website. Way back in the day, they were typed up, and we're currently trying to find a student to sort of digitize those at some point and put so that we can link to them as like a PDF if people want to see some pretty old school bibliographies.
Cool. Those sound really exciting. Are there any other exciting projects that you were like really enthusiastic about or proud of, or any specific bibliographies that you worked on that you were like...
Yeah, I mean, I'm working on one currently that's not published, but it's specifically for survivors of sexual violence seeking support services on campus. So having sort of one place where a survivor could go and see all of their options that are, you know, local, and then deciding what's best for them from there. So I've seen some other schools do things like that, and I think that's a really interesting and cool thing to do, because I think you can just, you know, be inundated with information, and that's like great, but also overwhelming. So I'm trying to just create something that, you know, is all in one place, local for UW students. So that's one that I'm excited about, but it's not up yet. So hopefully this semester I will finish that and it will be public. But yeah.
What about committees? Have you served on any committees?
Served on quite a few. Yes. So I think the first committee I served on was part of the Equity Diversity Committee, the subcommittee called CASE, Climate and Staff Engagement. So I was on there for 2 years, I believe, and got to learn a lot about the climate here at UW, specifically for staff in the libraries. And then I've been on a lot of different search and screen hiring committees, which has been interesting. Gosh, what other ones? I know I've been on some other ones too, but they're just like, there's so many. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's like typical of librarianship, I feel like. So, Carla and I co-facilitated, this wasn't a committee, but we co-facilitated a group called Confronting Whiteness in Libraries. And so it was sort of a discussion reading group, and to confront the overwhelming whiteness in libraries and in the profession. And that was a bit short-lived, but it was, I think, good while it lasted.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so I think Carla had the idea, but, you know, it's just, it's a thing that, I mean, it's a big issue everywhere, but it's also just specific to librarianship in that librarianship is still very white. Yeah, so it was trying to read up about how to deal with that and how to navigate it. And I think we read some different things. I think that's when we read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo and some other works too, of course. But it was for any library staff could attend. And we did have a pretty like good amount of, we had a good turnout. So that was nice to see. It was difficult in terms of having a bunch of white people, and there were some people of color in it, but having a bunch of white people who wanted to sort of center their experiences. And so that was a bit contentious and hard to deal with and sort of navigate and figure out what to do without totally alienating people. And of course, and because it's, you know, in a professional setting, and it can be very vulnerable for people. And so it was just, I think, a lot for Carla and I to sort of handle at the time. But we've considered coming back to it, so we'll see. But yeah.
And tell me more about your work with the Equity and Diversity Committee.
Yeah, so the subcommittee case that I was on, we were creating affinity groups. Yeah, that's what it was. I had to think about it. So primarily for new staff coming on who kind of, you know, want to find some like-minded people or people that they can connect with on a personal level, we created sort of these different affinity groups. We didn't create the groups, rather we created just the idea of the affinity groups, and then we surveyed staff to ask them for their suggestions as to, you know, what types of groups. Like, one group was for like a university staff group, because there's a lot of power dynamics between academic staff and university staff, even just within the libraries. And so it was whoever suggested it thought it was important to have a set space for university staff to come together and talk about things. These were things that, you know, these were groups that were not supposed to be necessarily on work time, or if they were, you had to get express permission from your supervisor, etc. Other groups would be, I'm trying to think what some of the other ones were. I think one was for parents, you know. One was for people of color. I think there was a specific one for Black people within the libraries. And the goal was to then be able to inform whoever the, you know, HR would be able to give a packet of information to new staff and say, like, this is a list of the affinity groups. These are the contacts for people. So they would just contact them themselves and not have to, like, necessarily out themselves to HR or to anybody. That was really important, so people didn't feel like they had to, you know, be in such a vulnerable space to do that. And yeah, I'm not sure where that's at now because I haven't been on the committee for a while, I think a year now or year and a half. But yeah, so.
That seems really interesting.
Yeah. I think it was a pretty cool suggestion to bring to creating more, to creating a better climate in the libraries among staff. And so, yeah.
And if you were to do the like reading group that you and Carla co-facilitated, mm-hmm. if you were to do that again, what are some things that you would like definitely keep the same or like mm-hmm. definitely do differently?
I mean, I think we had a lot of good readings. Carla created a whole like bibliography that she shared out to people. And so I think like that was really excellent, that part of it. I don't know that her and I are necessarily the best people to facilitate that. I think it might have been better if there was someone from outside of the libraries, maybe a person of color, although that also could be potentially problematic too, if that's, you know, putting too much on a person of color, too much labor for them to have to deal with white people saying ridiculous things or whatnot. But it might have been better too, because, you know, I think as employees of the libraries, we have to be pretty careful about what we say in groups like that and sort of how we say things and whatnot. And I think if we had an outside facilitator, they could sort of do more of whatever and maybe more gently call people out that need to be called out. I think just like, I mean, I personally don't have a lot of facilitator experience, so I can't speak for Carla, but I felt like kind of just not inept. I felt pretty inept at that at the time. So if I was going to do it again, I would want to take some sort of class or do some sort of training first, and go from there. But yeah, otherwise, I don't know if there are other things that I can think of right now that I would have necessarily changed. Yeah, just those things for now.
I mean, it seems like a really great idea.
Yeah, I think it is a cool idea, and it's needed, like, to be learning and educating yourself about that, especially if you're a white person. And for those of us in librarianship who are white, you know, so I think you can never have too much of that to be reading, and yeah.
So we're getting close. You said you have to leave at noon.
Yeah.
So I guess, is there anything else that you would like to say for now, about your work at the Office of the Gender and Women's Studies Librarian?
I don't think so. Just that it's a really magical place, and I hope that the office is in existence for another 40 plus years. But I hope more people know about it and it gets a lot more visibility, because it's kind of this just secret, you know, gem of the libraries that a lot of people don't know about and should know about. So.
So if more people knew about it, what could happen?
I don't know, there should be a couple more librarians. I would try for that position. I know it's like a lot for just Carla even, because she's the only librarian currently in the office, and she gets a ton of requests from people all over, not just UW system, but outside of UW system and internationally. Like, she's worked with people in like Kenya and, I mean, like all over, just like online and stuff. So I think it would be awesome if like it got more visibility and, could retain the space, if not have a bigger space, and have the potential for, a couple more more librarians, really. I think that would be really cool. 'Cause I think people don't you know, people outside of GWS don't understand how interdisciplinary it is. And really, it's, you know, anybody could use that kind of research and resource support. So I find it really valuable. And I just think it would be great to just let more people know about it and have more people come and use it. And yeah. And it's just a nice quiet space too. Like a lot of spaces in the libraries, but like very chill and yeah, comforting. So.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, then I guess we can wrap up for
today.
Okay. Thank you so much for making
time.